And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Home for All. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle, who actually is inside getting coffee right now. I don't know why he did that now when he's beginning the show.
We only have a couple seconds. These espressos are just pulled.
All right.
We don't want to wait a minute. 30 seconds is almost too much.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
We should drink our espresso.
Well,
it's fresh.
Yeah.
You don't have to drink the whole thing.
You know, radio shows begin like a train, okay? They leave at a certain... Okay, maybe not on Long Island, but... In many parts of the world, trains leave at a certain time, and that's when the show begins. And the fact that coffee is arriving now also is an unfortunate coincidence. But, okay, now we have to drink this very quickly, is what you're saying?
Well, no, just, you can have a sip. I mean, get the gist of it.
I haven't had a chance to tell the people anything yet. Okay, fine.
Yeah, but I have a certain method I like to do, but you're welcome to have both your drinks separately.
Well, we're having espresso, and then we're having coffee after that, right?
Take a sip at least while it's fresh.
Toast the coffee. There we go. What's everybody staring at? Oh, that's good.
That's very good.
As the first thing I've had today, that is really an awakening.
It's not bitter. We needed this.
We did.
And this is...
We do. I need more.
This is the best way to start your day in a new city.
Well, that's the thing. I haven't had a chance to tell the people where we are yet because of all this mayhem and craziness.
Oh, well, don't let me slow you down.
Too late for that. All right, look. We're still not back, in case you don't know that. We're in Vancouver now. We're not in Seattle anymore. We've gone up a little bit.
British Columbia.
We're British Columbia, Canada. Our neighbors to the north. Another country. I think everybody would get it by now.
Yep.
And we're at a coffee shop outside. And we're actually taping this yesterday. For us, obviously, it's today. Not because we're in Canada, but because... We're taking this Monday. A big tour bus just went up. One of those hop-on, hop-off things. Nobody hopped off when they saw us. We're here in Vancouver having our coffee right by the street, as you can tell. But before we talk about Vancouver and Canada and travels and things like that, I kind of like to focus on what's going on tonight. Tonight being tomorrow for us, but tonight for you listening. Or sometime in the past for you listening in the future.
Well,
I don't want to get confusing.
No. It's sort of the equivalent to one of our previous shows where we were describing the democratic process in Seattle. Well, the very same thing is occurring today in New York.
Not exactly the very same thing because we don't get the caucus like what you had, what I got to experience. And if you want to hear that, folks, let's do a few weeks back. I think it was the last show in March. Really awesome. Just democracy in action, I guess, is the way to say it. And that was just a great way to witness how a caucus works. And what we have tonight in New York is a primary. Actually, a couple of primaries.
That's right. It's the equivalent, but it is not, in fact, a caucus.
So people are voting both in the Democratic primary and the Republican primary. Last I checked, Hillary Clinton was scheduled to win against Bernie Sanders. But that could change. What are you doing?
Let me stop you right there.
You're pouring one cup into another.
Well,
what's going on?
I have a little bit of a ritual. If you were to call this what I'm doing, one specific drink... it would be called a shot in the dark. Yeah, a shot of espresso in the dark. But I don't even have dark because I put cream in my drink. Basically, it's an espresso and a mug of regular drip coffee.
All right.
Although I put cream in it. So what I like to do is I drink about half of my double espresso and then I pour a shot into my drip coffee and then finish it that way.
And there's no time limit on this?
No, I mean, I've had, you know, most of the espresso while it was fresh pulled from the machine, and now I'm going to move on to my mug of coffee, but I take whatever's sort of left in the espresso mug, and yeah, there, just like that.
Wow.
Dump it into my mug of drink coffee.
And smash your coffee down into the saucer.
Oh.
All right. Well, that's cool.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. Passion is important.
I like a little sugar, too.
But
okay. Well, go on, I'm listening.
I'm going to finish my espresso and drink my coffee like a human.
Okay.
And we also have croissants, too.
Yeah.
Is somebody grilling something? You know, we made specific requests for this street to be cleared of that kind of thing for the broadcast.
Yeah, we were told this was a quiet area.
I swear, I am going to have someone's head. What do we have to do?
I don't understand. I mean, these are Canadians. How noisy could they be?
Oh. Never been to a Canucks game, eh? Actually, I'm sorry. This is a bad time for Canadians because for the first time since, I looked this up, since like the 1960s, no Canadian team is in the Stanley Cup, the Stanley Cup playoffs. And at that time it happened in the 1960s, there were only two Canadian teams. And that was the first time it had happened, I think, ever. So, I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. What were we saying?
Well, Hillary and Bernie are facing off in this primary in New York, and they're going to be both getting results. Now, because I was caucusing, I think the Democrats put me on a list. I get email from Bernie now.
You get email from Bernie Sanders?
Bernie Sanders, yeah. And he sent a blast out the other night about some poll, some thing. Basically, the tone was, we're probably not going to win New York, but it doesn't matter, we just need a lot of delegates.
That's what he said, we're probably not going to win New York?
It was a very odd tenor, and hopefully that's not true, but there was some statistic where, you know, she was at 53, he's at 47, they're trying to make up, but the sense is that on the Democratic side, perhaps he's not going to be as strong. We'll see, though.
Well, I hope he's not getting depressed. I hope that he's keeping his spirits up. If he were to win New York, it would be amazing. It would be a big victory, and he would still be in the race quite substantially. He still is in the race regardless, but having that happen would be, I guess, a surprise, but he surprised people before.
Yeah, I really hope that the momentum and everything continues. I am a little worried because the contributions he's asking for seem to be going down. It was like $3, and now it's like $2.70 because of the whole 27 thing. Before that, it was $27 as the average. I don't know if he's going to start asking for pocket change.
Well, he's pretty much wiped everybody out as far as people can give money.
Yeah, and I thought to myself, gosh, you know, what if I just donated X this? X? But you have to realize all this money just goes to ads.
That's true. And you know, this speaks to my idea that I've broached many times and I've been ignored many times, that since ads are on public airwaves, they shouldn't cost anything. The television and radio station should be required to provide free political advertising to as many candidates as qualify for the campaign. And or you could even have a channel set aside just for that and nothing else. In fact, why not both? That wipes out that barrier to everybody where you can't run unless you're a millionaire or you can raise millions of dollars. And it's really kind of a pathetic way of running a campaign. It takes away from all the issues. I think it's always been the biggest problem whenever anything like this happens.
Yeah. Money in campaigns. I do like the ad channel, political ad channel, dedicated channel for that. That's a very interesting idea. I would want you to be able to record. You have to the DVR has to be able to work with that, though.
Yeah,
you know, you can get your hour blast, because all of the good channels aren't something you can record. And I would want to get my dose of ads, you know, an hour. I wouldn't want repeats and coming halfway through. And, yeah, it'd have to be set up well.
Well, you're referring to our local cable network here, or our cable system here on Long Island. For some reason, you can't record the government channel. You can't record public affairs.
18, 20, all of them.
Yeah, if you hit the record button, it says this channel is not able to be recorded.
And there's still no NASA TV. Anyway.
There's no NASA TV.
Total diversion.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about this for hours if we keep that up. Okay, but there's another campaign going on tonight, too, and that, of course, is Trump versus Cruz.
I'm sorry, who?
And the other guy, too, Kasich. Which, you know, he could not. I don't think he's going to win.
The banquet king.
Well, you know, I'm embarrassed to say Trump is going to win New York handily, but you got to understand, there are the people who vote for Trump are in all different states, so those are the only people that are coming out tonight to vote in the Republican primary. Well, other people as well voting for Cruz.
But more people are going to vote for Trump than for Cruz, who participate in that particular primary. So it's going to seem like New York really supports Trump, but all it means is that the people who vote in the Republican primary support Trump in New York.
Which comparatively isn't a lot of people.
When November comes around, it's not going to count at all because New York will go Democratic. And because of our silly system, it's all or nothing, and New York will just be a blue state.
In other words, you're saying if there were just a couple hundred people on the Republican side expressing their opinion, and then you have hundreds of thousands of Democrats, it's still equal primaries, even though there's not as much participation on one side or the other. It's not as representative of the state as a whole.
Yeah, something like that. Obviously, there's more than a few hundred.
Sure.
But it's not as... It's going to seem overwhelming tomorrow morning, I think, when people look at the results. It'll seem like New York is going crazy for Trump. And believe me, that is not the case. In fact, you know, I'm a little upset because we've been traveling, and Trump came to Long Island while he knew not to come while we were there. But he came to Long Island twice, once in Patchogue, that was really kind of shameful and really disturbing. Most disturbing that I wasn't there able to protest it.
Right. There was an incident there, and really using it as a backdrop.
You're talking about the hate crime years ago. Yeah, we talked about that on this show.
Yeah.
An immigrant was murdered just for being an immigrant.
It's fascinating how framing is being used. People can take one thing, turn it around, twist it inside out, and use it to say something entirely different, something that might not represent the victim or whomever is at the effect of these things. And nobody bats an eyelash. Nobody questions it, and not enough people question it.
Oh, enough people question this, I think. And Trump got the welcome he deserved in Patchogue. But you know, it strikes me that why would you go to Patchogue? You know, the place where that happened. You know, it's even if it's not an intentional decision, you realize, hey, this is a place where something horrible happened, and I'm speaking to people that seem to buy into that kind of horrible logic. So maybe I should maybe go to Islip or something, or some other place. Any
Medford.
Place else but that. Yeah, well, that's getting closer to us. But yeah, it just reflects how ill-advised this whole campaign is.
It would have been very interesting to see what options, what did they narrow down from to get to Patchogue, right? What were the options? I mean, they probably ruled the Hamptons out right away, because that just... You know, screams opulence.
Well, you know, Stony Brook was not even in the running.
I mean, somebody had to throw that in there just for a laugh.
Right, right.
And then, I mean, Montauk? It's nice. He could have been on the beach, you know. And
it's at the very tip of the island. You usually push him into the ocean and
cast
him adrift. That would be something to think about.
Yeah, he would have, like, melted or something. there's just a lot of places on this island, and you'd think that they'd use some sort of process to narrow it down to get a good spot, something that is flattering, in other words. And it just seems like the choice there was really confusing. And as I said, it's an example of how framing has been used and twisted various backdrops around. In this process.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So that's where we stand politically right now. We don't know how it's going to turn out tonight, and neither do you, because it hasn't happened yet when you're listening to this live on the air. But we'll know next week, and I guess we'll discuss it a little bit then. But let's get back to what we've been doing, because that's more interesting, I think. We've been traveling around. Last few shows have been in Seattle. We weren't on last week. I know a lot of people wrote in wondering where we were. Last week was the Bluesathon, where we played blues music for 24 hours on WUSB. And you know what? Saturday was the Vinylthon. Guess what we did then?
Played vinyl records?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I guess we talked about it.
Phonograph?
Yeah, actual vinyl records.
Recording?
Because we have this huge vinyl library at the radio station, which we love, which is you know, one of the most amazing treasures to have. And it harkens back to our early days as a radio station back in the 60s. We became an FM station in the 1970s, but we became... Wow, it's a massive bus just passed by. What's so funny about that? There's a lot of noise. We're in a city, Kyle, a big city. We'll get to that in a second. But vinyl, yeah, we have this huge vinyl library, and we've been preserving it since the 60s. We've been getting records from record companies since before we went on the air FM. We were a carrier current radio station, meaning you had to plug into a wall to get us. I think it was 8:20 a.m. Only people on campus in dormitories could get us. But we ran the place like a we ran the place like a professional radio station, and we're treated as such by the record companies. And that's continued to this day, where we get music on CD or digitally. We have the most incredible library, and as we move to a new facility, we're preserving all of that, and we're becoming stronger than ever. It's pretty awesome. So we had the Vinylthon last Saturday, we had the Bluesathon last Tuesday, and that's why we weren't on last week.
It's exciting too. I mean, it's really an example of the curse of abundance. Having a lot of music, a lot of recordings, a lot of media just all over. And it's been amazing looking at it and planning these sorts of events around it, but also getting a sort of handle on how maybe we can better organize it and preserve it, as you said, and honor the years and years that it took to acquire and accumulate that kind of variety and huge amount of source material for shows and stuff.
I think the last time we were on, we were in Seattle. Well, we definitely were in Seattle. I'm trying to remember. Was that the show where the train passed by? I'm sorry for that train, by the way, folks. I know that completely overmodulated, but, you know, when a locomotive passes only a few feet away from you and then blows its horn, there's nothing you can do to make that sound good. There's just nothing. And we couldn't edit that out because that was the whole point of the train passing by, was blowing its horn at that moment. But I love Seattle because of all the trains that are passing by. Many reasons I love Seattle, but that's one of the reasons. We had a great time there. It's where you come from, obviously, and personify the place. Since then, we've traveled on. We took the Clipper, which is a high-speed boat that goes from Seattle to Victoria. And it's something you've always wanted to do.
Yeah, I've never, ever been on this particular boat, and never taken this method of transportation to Canada, and I suggested it. I know there's a couple other ferries and so on, but this is the most direct route, and I thought it would be a really cool way to get there. You can also take the train, you can take buses, you can drive. I've done any number of those things. You can even bicycle across the border. You tend to have long lines with the cars at the border and so on, and customs checks and so on. This was probably the best way. It really would have been much more of a hassle, I think. And man, I mean, the hardest part for us was just making sure we were up and at the dock and ready to go. But it was really interesting. We stayed close to the actual port there, which gave us the advantage of being able to make it on time and everything. And it was really a lot like getting onto a plane. We lined up, and without as much screening and craziness around removing articles of clothing and so on.
Yeah, without all the stress. And what you mentioned, I think, was also key, staying at a place nearby. For some reason, this Clipper usually only leaves once a day at 8 in the morning. I don't know why only once a day. But for some reason, there was a second boat this day that wasn't listed anywhere else. It wasn't on their schedule, but I found out about it. It was at 9 o'clock, still very early. And if we were going from where we were staying in another part of Seattle, it would have taken us literally hours to get there. And we probably would have had to stay up all night. So what we did was we stayed at a place, a very cheap place, right nearby, and literally we could roll down the hill and be at the terminal in a couple of minutes. But that's the other thing. You know, when we came into that part of town the previous night, it felt like we were going to a different country, because we took the Sounder, which is the commuter rail of Seattle, but it runs so infrequently. There's only about 5 trains that run into the city in the morning and 2 that run into the city in the afternoon, and that's it, and the rest run in the other direction in the afternoon and morning. But we finally found one of those trains, took it into the city, and then took a bus to the part of town that was by the ferry terminal. By that time, we were exhausted. It felt like we had traveled for hours. I guess we had traveled for hours, and it was like being in a different place.
Yeah, the regional rail, that running that infrequently with as few riders as it seems at some of the off-peak hours is a little embarrassing. I mean, we really can do better. I hope that some of that stuff expands, and I think that particular train, the Sounder, will have more departures and stuff. They're working on it in 2017, so hopefully it'll improve.
Well, the problem is they share the rails with freight trains. So freight trains that I like. I like seeing freight trains going by all the time, but apparently they're in control of the rail, and that means they can't run very many passenger lines. I don't understand why they can't resolve that. Build more tracks if they have to. Work out a schedule. It's the same problem with Amtrak. You know, we need to deal with that and realize that passenger rail is important as well. Anyway, that's a whole show in and of itself. We took the Clipper up to Victoria, hung out there for a day, and we then had to figure out how to get to Vancouver from Victoria, which involved a long bus ride, a slow ferry ride, but a shorter ferry ride, and then another bus, train, and bus ride to where we were staying in Vancouver.
That's right. The BC ferry system was really interesting. It's roughly the same size as the Washington State ferry system, and similar in a lot of ways, passenger as well as vehicle ferries. Their boats were a lot bigger, though, I think, than anything you normally would see in Seattle. So that was my first time on a BC ferry, which is really interesting the way it navigates some of the small islands. There are some pretty tight turns and narrow pathways on the route that it took to get to Vancouver, but it was a pleasant journey, and we basically just took in the scenery, and it was a little bit slower than the Clipper, but it was really neat. There was a lot of people on there, all kinds of different things going on, people coming and going, day trips, weekend trips, sports, adventuring, and various teams of soccer and football clubs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we saw an entire soccer team. Well, several different. Coastal FC, I think, is what they were called. A bunch of kids, all different levels, some coming, some going. I guess that's the training system they have in British Columbia. It's really cool to see. And then when we got to Vancouver, it was like literally a breath of fresh air, because I identify very much with a city that's open late. And that's something that, it's so scarce. Every place we've been, and we've been taking trains across the United States. We stopped in Chicago and L.A. And came up to Seattle. But every city pretty much shuts down at a certain time. And Vancouver seems to stay up late and have things that are open until 2 in the morning and beyond.
Yeah, and we had slightly rough landing, at least as far as negotiating accommodations. Apparently, it's a very busy weekend, and it was difficult to book something a day before at some of the different places we were looking at. But that finally getting resolved put us out on the street, sort of hungry and looking for a place to get some sustenance at hours that other cities would be very challenging. At hours that it would be very challenging in other cities to find that stuff. It was really...
That's a garbage truck.
It was really refreshing, though, to see so many people out and find late-night food, good food. A lot of Asian cuisine, really representative of the Pacific Rim, and all different types of food. Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, Malaysian, Thai, you name it, we could find it out here. So we basically knocked around a bit, getting a sense of the neighborhood and found some good food.
It's really cool to just walk around and explore and learn where things are. You have to do that. And you can't do that just by staying inside or reading a guide or even being in mass transit. You have to walk. You have to actually see what's... That's how we found this coffee shop we're at right now, by walking around. And we found another street down the road, Davie Street, which what you call a gayborhood, which
yes.
is really amazing. I've never seen anything quite like this.
Yeah, it's an entire strip, like probably 20 blocks total, maybe 15 blocks, that is just emblazoned with rainbow flags everywhere, rainbow crosswalks, rainbow symbols, and every shop at every restaurant, and it's sort of different than what I'm used to in Seattle and Capitol Hill and on what we know as Broadway, which is a very famous gayborhood in Seattle. But the queer identity and the pride here in Vancouver is really impressive. There is a lot of symbolism and just an enormous neighborhood. I would say it's like three times the size of Capitol Hill in terms of continuity for that kind of community. So it was really cool to walk through there and just see like tops of buildings painted in rainbow colors, and it was just everywhere. And the people were really really friendly, and again, places were open late. You look, it's like 2 a.m. and you ask yourself, am I in New York? I mean, really had a night like this was on a weekend, on a Sunday even. It was incredible, like
yeah.
just seeing such distinct communities. We walked around in Chinatown a little bit here.
Huge Chinatown.
Absolutely. And sort of some of the industrial stuff near the port reminded us of Queens, where there's a lot of warehouses and that kind of thing. And even downtown and in some of the outlying areas we explored, we found our train station, sort of the oldest train station in the city. And we looked at some of the other train stops along the way. The SkyTrain system is interesting here. It's sort of above ground and underground.
It's like an automated train. It goes to the airport, but it goes to other places as well. There's, I think, four different kinds.
And there's a bunch of arenas, and I know the Olympic Village was over in that area as well,
mm-hmm.
Because Vancouver hosted the Olympic Games a couple years back. We also took the C bus to North Vancouver.
That's right. I almost forgot about that.
Yeah. That was unlike anything I'd ever been on. It was sort of a ferry, but more like what you would say the Staten Island ferry. It's passengers only.
It's a ferry, yeah.
And
it's
just
pretty much as a ferry can be, I think.
Quite ferry.
Yeah, and it's a quick ride. It's about 10 minutes long.
And there's multiple doors. You get on one side, you get off the other side. Pretty much automated and very regular, just back and forth every 10-15 minutes. It's really interesting. And going over to North Vancouver, you get a great perspective on the other side of the bay and the city, obviously. You pass by a lot of the shipping and sort of industrial loading and offloading of container ships and various other vessels. But that side, I guess, is more more residential. Seems to be a bit more recent as far as sprawl and a little quieter. Apparently it's known for some of the like film and production stuff that is here in Vancouver, which I could see. It's a little quieter over there. Maybe that's conducive to that. You do see quite a bit of production vehicles and that kind of stuff all around Vancouver.
Yeah, a lot of production for the United States is done in Canada, and a lot of that is done in Vancouver.
Yeah. In fact, we saw some old police cars right on the water there. I think it was SFPD. So, like, all these 80s or 70s Chevrolets that had San Francisco Police Department logos, and they were all rigged up for flames and fire. Like, they had piping for like, gases and stuff to show, like, a car fire. So that was really interesting to see, and it really, really was amazing to get a lay of the land and use their transit system, which is very new. They've got this Oyster system. It's called Compass.
Okay, well, now you're going to call it Oyster. Oyster is what they call it in London, right? Oyster card?
You're right. It was a tap. It's more like a tap system.
But what you call it in Seattle is Orca.
Orca, yeah, it's an Orca.
And what they call it here is Compass. So what are we talking about? We're talking about...
And in L.A., it's the tap.
Okay, then what's it in Chicago? They have one there, too. Yeah.
I can't remember.
All right, well, it's got a name, too, I'm sure. And New York will be getting one. I'm pretty sure New York will be getting one. Hopefully, they'll do it the right way. These are RFID cards that are used for mass transit, and it's an amazing system. Metro cards, what we use in New York City right now, that's the old way, and that's going to be history pretty soon. What we'll have instead is a system where you basically tap a card against the reader, and the turnstile opens, and you're allowed in. What they have here is a system that that works on buses, that works on trains, that works on ferries.
The Sea Bus,
the Sky Train, they like making words like that. And it's really, it's a very easy-to-use system, and that's why I hope they do it properly in New York. The difference in New York is that you don't have to tap out on any mass transit system, and the reason for that is because there is no change in fare either for time of day or for distance. It's not the case here. You have to pay more if you go to a certain place, and I don't know if it changes in rush hour. So hopefully when they implement this in New York, which they have to do at some point, you'll just tap in and you won't have to tap out. And the system is really simple. We have day passes. What you do is you go up to the vending machine and you hold your compass card up to the reader and say that you want to refill it or add something to it. And then you pay using cash or a credit card or whatever you choose. And then you hold your compass card up to the reader again, and it basically is programmed. You can also do this online, although we had a frustrating experience. We tried to do it online, entered all the information, and the very last entry said you have to have a Canadian address for your credit card for this to work, after I had already entered all the information to do this. So it doesn't always work in the most convenient way. But once the system actually is in place, you simply hop on buses, hold your card up to the reader, and you're allowed in. It's very, very simple. The other concern, though, I have is tracking. Now, when you tap out, obviously, any authority can tell where you got off the bus or where you got off the train. So tapping out is something that I'm a little wary of, and that's why another reason why I hope New York does not implement that, but for reasons of increasing fares to certain zones and also for monitoring where people actually go.
Yeah, and when you use these kinds of things, you have to be quite cognizant. You have to be aware that that is a possibility at any one time. And even if you paid with cash and, like, just wandered as sort of anonymously as you could, your face or other stuff that identifies you could be associated with that card. And then, I mean, that would only have to occur one time to then track that card based on verifying that you're the person doing that, and it remains sort of in a consistent pattern. There's all kinds of techniques for adding variables and being certain or able to verify that you're tracking someone. And you have to just appreciate that the technology allows for these things. It also allows for great flexibility for you as a traveler or someone getting around town. But there are these sort of vulnerabilities or other things that come along with the technology. So it's going to be interesting to see how that works in New York City. And we're continuing to compare different systems, but it really is, it's amazing. We go to many different countries. We first started seeing this in London and in Holland. And it now seems that the disposable RFID, the disposable paper cards are less prevalent. In fact, they want you to buy these plastic cards, and you and I have accrued several of them now from different cities.
Yes.
And we'll probably have quite a portfolio of these reusable, refillable RFID cards. And we're almost starting to wonder what happens when you start mixing them around in different cities.
Well, in Seattle, I did that. I accidentally used an LA card to get on a bus. And the guy didn't know what it was, and he said, "No, just get on." I realized later I used the wrong city, and I corrected my mistake. So, yeah, these cards will be seen in many different places. But I think you're going to have similar systems popping up. I mean, we saw it in London many years ago, the Oyster card that you mentioned. And now we're starting to see it being used in more complex ways. In Seattle, for instance, I was very impressed with just the instructions. Basically, you can store different fares on one card. You can have a day pass, but you can also have value on your card, and there's a hierarchy in the way that it's used. And people have to understand this. People have to look it over and figure out how they want to use their card, and it will calculate the best price for you. And it's just part of an improvement of mass transit. The other improvement that I really want to focus on that we need in New York is something that I've seen in so many other places. Let's say you're on a bus. It tells you what stop you're going to be approaching. It displays it. And it's not a hard thing to do. But we have yet to do that in New York City. We don't have screens that will display that information. That way, you know, if you're new to the city and you have to get off at a certain stop, if you don't ask the driver, tell me when we get here, you see it. You see it on the display. This is the next stop. So you ring the button and ask to be let off there. And it's really quite simple. The infrastructure has to be in place, though, to allow that, to detect where the bus is. The other thing is how long before the next bus shows up. Many cities now have countdown clocks that are accurate. New York, you can't seem to get that right. For the few trains that have that, it's incredibly inaccurate. So these little improvements help make life a lot easier and more bearable for people that are new to the city.
That is absolutely the case in Seattle as well. We noticed many times waiting at bus stops where people would be incredibly frustrated. They missed a bus, they waited for another one, it's, you know, late at night, they're ending up waiting for an hour, they barely missed the next one because they went to go get a cup of coffee. I mean, it is really, really absurd considering that it is in the interest of these transit systems to track their vehicles, whether it is a subway or a bus or another mode of transportation. So once, they have that system in place for their own sort of operational capability, allowing other displays and apps or whatever it may be to access that information and give people reliable countdowns allows the citizens and the people that are moving around and using the system to have a lot more faith and be more efficient in how they use the system.
You raise a good point there because, you know, for all my doubts about tracking technology, the fact that we're always advertising where we are, our vehicles are tracked, our phones are tracked, our every whereabout is known constantly. I don't have a problem with mass transit vehicles being tracked so that we know where the bus is, that we know where the train is. We have that technology. It's there. Let's start using it so that people can plan around these things a lot more efficiently. It's working in other places. It can definitely work in New York. So what else have we noticed here that's different? Right now we're sitting at an intersection, actually. This is kind of interesting, where the traffic light is flashing green on the street that we're on.
That's right.
And you might not know what that means if you don't study it for a little while. What's a flashing green light mean? What that apparently means here, or I don't know if it's just British Columbia or if it's Canada in general, is that there is no traffic light for the other road that bisects this particular road, the flashing green light. So it's kind of like a flashing orange, and the other street has a stop sign or flashing red. In this particular case, though, the flashing green light can turn to red when pedestrians cross, when they press the button to get the walk sign to light up. Then it turns red, and of course the people still have their stop sign on the bisecting road. I guess green, flashing green, just means you got right away, but be careful.
Right.
And it sometimes doesn't quite work out. We see people kind of getting a little confused sometimes, but it's unusual. It's one of those unusual things. You know, there's another unusual thing, actually. I wanted to mention this in Seattle. I kind of like this idea. You see these traffic lights everywhere that have turn lanes. They have two yellow arrows, not one. They've got a green, they've got yellow arrow number one, yellow arrow number two, and red arrow. So what happens is that one of the yellow arrows, the first one, the one next to the green, the default state is for that to be flashing. And what that means is, if it's safe to go, you can make a left turn. You don't have to stop and wait for the light to turn green like we have in New York, and a big waste of time. For some reason, though, they don't use the same yellow arrow when it's about to turn red. The second one lights up then, and then it turns red. That's when the bisecting road gets to go. I like that system, though. I see those lights everywhere in Seattle and maybe other parts of Washington State as well. And I'm wondering if that's part of an experiment that might catch on in the rest of the country.
Yeah, I actually, when you pointed it out, didn't necessarily know what it meant, although it was logical when you explained it. I would just sort of operate on sort of a natural sense of when to go and when it was not safe to go at those intersections. But that's a very, very good point. Another thing I noticed here is a lot of the street signs have bicycles on them. And there's a lot of signage for bicycle lanes. There's also green bicycle lanes. But basically, any street that has a shared lane or is a part of a bicycle path has on that street sign a bicycle, so drivers and bicyclists know where they will be, where they will be sharing the path. There's really a lot of consideration for cyclists in this city, and quite a few cyclists, which I really like. I like the amount of symbols and signage that they provide. That's important because it reminds drivers that they are sharing the road, and it creates, I think, a safer set of pathways to get around the city.
Something else that we noticed walking around yesterday in a different part of town, we were going down this street, minding our own business, looking in the store windows, and we noticed that people were just kind of acting differently. They were, how do you say this?
Disheveled?
A little disheveled, okay, fine. I'm used to that. But kind of acting a little out of it, let's say. And then it wasn't just one or two people. It was like five people, eight people, 10 people. Then it was like 50 people. Then it was 100 people. And all of a sudden, we were in this neighborhood where everybody seemed to be on drugs. And apparently everybody was.
Yeah. Yeah, in some state of getting high or coming down. But yeah, there was a lot of a very particular type of people with a certain look, and you had to wonder what is this about? Where is this? Why is this coalescing here? What are the causes of this? And it is actually in relation to heroin use and drugs in general in Vancouver have had sort of an interesting history. Cannabis is sort of tolerated, but not necessarily legal. That's an entirely, a huge and entirely different discussion, but it's related in that there's a sense of maturity around the use of drugs here. And to that end, in that part of town, just several blocks from where it started to appear to be, I guess you would say seedy, but sort of like a junkie flea market, was a safe injection site. It's called Insight. And we had actually seen a couple stories about this on Canadian news, and were aware that it would be in town. And it, I think, is an, as you said, it's an interesting way to handle it. It's different than what we're used to. This is something that occurs in Seattle a lot. There are a lot of people like this in Seattle, but we turn a blind eye to them.
Mm-hmm.
We don't support them. We, you know, close off parks where they're sleeping. We, you know, have certain overpasses and bridges and highways where we know people are living in tents and so on. And we tend to refer to it as a homeless problem or a tent city, and these kinds of words are used about around it, when in fact a lot of what's going on is drug use. And I think that there are definitely non-drug users, and there is a variety of people, but in Seattle we're not necessarily handling it in the same way. And the stark contrast is right here. You see this place where people who are using heroin, who are going to use heroin, they already have purchased it and would otherwise be using it in bathrooms or out on the street somewhere, can go in and be supervised by a nurse and have clean clean, sharp needles and so on to administer the drugs themselves, and they have access to resources while they're there to prevent transmission of disease, to prevent overdose, to maybe hook them up with toiletries and supplies they might need.
And maybe help them get off of it, too.
Absolutely. Maybe work with them and find resources to get them on a different path.
Well, it's interesting because the one thing I did not feel when I was walking through that crowd of people was in any way in danger. I didn't feel like we were about to be attacked or even harassed. Nobody even talked to us. They were just basically living their lives. It just was very, very strange. And, yeah, I've seen how drugs have been handled in the States for many years now, and the only thing I can conclude is that doesn't work. So, yeah, maybe something else should be tried. I don't know if this is the answer. It does seem very strange and weird, but I don't see people, I don't see any violence, I don't feel any kind of imminent threat. Of course, not having guns around is definitely a plus, and that's something... that in Canada you just don't have that problem. So that right away lessens the odds of bad things happening.
It's definitely part of why it works here. And we noticed how the aggression.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more aggression, there's a lot more disdain from those in sort of the well-to-do parts of the city in the U.S., in Seattle. Like, it just doesn't compare to at least the fact that these people can have their own community and maybe find support. And I think that because they have, like, a small community and there is less violence, the aggression, and there are resources, I think, and there's tolerance for it, the aggression is just dramatically less. But the one thing I did notice that does concern me is that I feel like for every person that might be helped, there's 10 more people that are just going to continue to languish. So if someone gets off through this safe injection or other kinds of resources, there's plenty of other people who will just be in and out of coming down or relapsing and so on.
Yeah, I don't want to give a wrong impression. These people are not well. They're not healthy. This is not something to aspire to. But one thing that I can say is they don't appear to be desperate. And desperate people do desperate things. And desperate people with weapons do horrible things. So at least we're entering the conversation in a better place. And maybe, just maybe, this will lead to something a bit more positive, maybe some kind of an actual treatment to this international menace that's been taking place with the proliferation of heroin
and opioids. Absolutely. Yeah. And no, that is the distinction right there. With support, you create a baseline of at least good humor, and you eliminate a lot of the real drastic, the dire situations people end up in. If you can create an area or a zone or a baseline of support, at least you're eliminating the worst of it as far as consequences.
Right. It's good to see problems dealt with in a different way, because whether it's mass transit or drug abuse, seeing how different tactics work gives you ideas on maybe something else that has not been tried before. I just feel that we think we know the answers, we think we know what won't work, we're not willing to try different things in so many ways, and this is just one more example of that. Hey, we're almost out of time, believe it or not, but you know, I know people are going to ask this question: what is that noise that you've been hearing for the entire hour? That noise is something else, that little cuckoo thing. That's an audible walk sign, so that people who are blind can cross the street and know when it's safe to do so. It might be driving you crazy, and you get used to it, just like so many other things. This city is very handicap accessible. There's elevators everywhere, and things for blind people and deaf people. And again, we're learning from that as well, and we're improving on so many levels.
Yeah, there is a lot of consideration for that, and I think you see a lot more people out and about because they have access to medical equipment, scooters, walkers, all that kind of stuff, that allows you to be ambulatory in whatever situation you're in. That's so crucial. You need to be able to get out and see people and get services and goods to maintain your life.
That's something, it brings back, we were in Victoria. We didn't really talk about Victoria. That was the first city we stopped in after going from Seattle on the Clipper. And we noticed, as soon as we got to Victoria, that there were a whole lot of older people on the streets. They were just basically in scooters or walking around. You noticed it right away. And you noticed the same thing in England. Just more elderly people outside doing things, active, as opposed to being shut-ins, being in a home someplace, just being cast away. And you were wondering if maybe the national health care system has something to do with that. And I think that's a large part of it. It's also the fact that Victoria, and I think Vancouver as well, are very desirable for elderly people to retire. The climate is good. But, I think it's a very healthy thing to see that, to see people able to get around, be accepted by society, be still a part of society. We don't see that enough.
Accepted and a huge part of that. They are their own community. They walk together. They're passing by on the street. They see other elderly people getting on just as they are. That has to be good psychologically. And just from where I come from, the Pacific Northwest, in Seattle specifically, and other parts of the country, we've noticed it's very, very much about segregating, and we are very ageist. We don't want age groups to mix, and we tend to put older people away. And I think that it's incredibly wrong, because they aren't stimulated. They tend to end up in little retirement homes, and that's the breadth, the total span of their ability to move around is, you know, from the cafeteria back to their room. It's horrible. Like, that is probably the worst way to handle it. And we wonder why people have all of these conditions and so on. Well, they're not getting out. They're not active. They're not sharing ideas on how to handle their abilities or lack thereof with other old people who might have some other common situations they could relate to.
And the cities aren't easy for them to get around. It's not built in a way that elderly people or handicapped people can easily get from one place to another. That's so important. We have to pay more attention to that.
Yeah, you can't just plan your life around stopping as soon as you lose your license. Like, that is deplorable. I mean, that is awful. And I've been through that with family members, and I myself would like to live in a place where, if I'm not able to drive, I can continue to have fun and enjoy myself.
Yeah, I think that's what it's all about. And I see so much inclusion here in Canada, particularly in British Columbia, where you don't feel like an outcast, no matter what your background is, whether you're hooked on drugs, whether you're handicapped, whether you're elderly, whether you're a bus driver making a tight turn on a corner. Whether you're crossing the street and can't see the sign, or whether you're just having a cup of coffee in a nice cafe.
Yeah, people respect and acknowledge where people are coming from, regardless of what that may be.
Well, I've enjoyed Vancouver. Wow, that's a squeaky truck there. I've enjoyed Vancouver, I've enjoyed Victoria, and whatever else we do, I'm sure we'll have some more adventures and we'll report back.
I'm eager to continue exploring and seeing the rest of this country.
And if you haven't voted tonight, get out there.